Estamos convencidos que todos...
¿Todos?
Tenemos la capacidad de impactar. Capitalista Consciente es un espacio para presentar buenas ideas, compartir grandes proyectos y mostrar cómo cada granito de arena cuenta ante un mar de oportunidades y un mundo por transformar.
Un espacio para escuchar nuevas ideas, cuestionar nuestra forma de pensar y, sobre todo, un espacio para cambiar juntos nuestra forma de actuar.
Esta segunda temporada es presentada por Integralis,
ayudando a las organizaciones a construir un mejor normal.
Welcome to another chapter of Conscious Capitalism. Today, more than ever, we can personally say that when you do things because of a personal purpose, dreams do come true. When we began this project, we thought we were going to be able to host today's guest way into the future. However, we have him today with us, and we're beyond excited. It is impossible to talk about conscious capitalism without referring to our guest. Today's chapter is a dream and a great opportunity for all of us that are listening and for us that we're recording, because you will get to hear not only the story of conscious capitalism, but to be able to get to know a little bit more personally to today's guest. Rash, welcome to Capitalista Consciente, and thank you for accepting the invitation of being with us today.
When we started this project, we dream about today's conversation, and it was something we talked about, that we wanted to one day in the future have today's conversation. And we did a lot of things, and we talked to many people and even to some institutions to get help, to get that process to get accelerated. And we couldn't, like, people didn't trust on the idea, on the dream of creating this podcast and one day bringing people from other countries and talk about this. And what we wanted to say today is that when there's something so close to your heart and so close to your purpose, no matter other people don't believe in you, if it's something you really trust, you will get it. So we would like to start today asking you and welcoming you, Rash, and to ask you, how did conscious capitalism started? How did your journey started?
Well, my journey into conscious capitalism came out of my research, which around 2005, I started a research project which really shifted the direction of my work. I had done, so I had been a professor since 85, so 20 years. But I had done work that was more in the mainstream of business and marketing, right, about strategy. I had done a book about strategy called The Rule of Three, and I had done a book on globalization and so forth. But I had also, within marketing, really been focused on what was not working well, which I did not understand why we were spending so much money and getting bad outcomes, right, in marketing. So I was focused on efficiency, on effectiveness, on productivity, on ethics. And so a lot of my academic work over a 10, 15-year period was on what's wrong with marketing. Then I did a book called Does Marketing Need Reform? How do we need to evolve it and change it? And so all of that then led in 2005 to a book proposal or idea called In Search of Marketing Excellence. I said, most companies are spending so much money on marketing, and yet their customer loyalty and trust are going down. Even as spending is going up, customer loyalty and trust are declining, and there's something wrong with that picture. And the fact is, you cannot buy loyalty and you cannot buy trust. You have to earn it, right? So just spending a lot of money on ads and coupons and junk mail doesn't achieve that, and yet everybody's doing that. So one of the things that really opened my eyes in 2004, when we did the analysis, we found that there was about $1 trillion being spent that year on marketing in the U.S. Now, $1 trillion was the GDP of India that year. And I said, there's a billion plus people living on what we are spending on ads, coupons, and junk mail. And what are we getting for that? What are we getting for customers, companies, and society? And my answer from all my work said, not much. And in fact, we're getting some negative consequences. Customers don't trust marketing. If it's marketing, that means it's not real. right? We did a study on the image of marketing. We found about 85% or more of Americans don't trust marketing. Companies get really poor returns on their marketing spending. You know, 99% of ads are never remembered. 99% of coupons are never redeemed. Most of the direct mail that comes into our mailbox goes straight into the trash. So it's so wasteful, right? And then at a societal level, we felt that marketing was causing, you know, overconsumption. It was stimulating the economy, but causing people to really, you know, the obesity crisis, diabetes crisis, all of those things. There's a lot of unhealthy things, behaviors that we promote by aggressive marketing, as well as using, you know, women's bodies to sell products. That has an impact on the psyche of young women. Aggressively marketing to children, junk food and junk cereals and all of that, and taking advantage of old. So there's just a lot of challenges, right? So I said there has to be a better way to do this. So that search led me to discover, okay, which are companies that don't spend much money and yet customers love them, right? So that's really the holy grail, I think. When the reality is that companies spend a lot of money and customers don't trust them, well, what's the opposite of that? I started to look for those kinds of companies. And we found Whole Foods and a few others that were like that. Whole Foods was spending 95% less on marketing than its industry average. Wow. And they did not have a chief marketing officer. They did not have an ad agency, right? And all their money was spent at the store level. And most of it had to do with community outreach, you know? So they thought of marketing in a way, they didn't even think about marketing. All they thought about is, let's do the right thing for our customers and take care of their health and well-being. Right, let's provide the best quality products and educate them. And what we found was there was a bigger picture there that wasn't just about customers, that these companies, they treated everybody with respect and cared for them, employees, communities, suppliers, right? So we found that there was a stakeholder mindset, that if you were truly stakeholder oriented, then you didn't need to spend a lot of money on marketing. You got positive word of mouth. You know, your employee turnover was very low. Right, people came and they stayed, and again, there's positive word of mouth. You know, suppliers are loyal, so there's a stakeholder mindset. And then we discovered, as we looked further into what made these companies special, is that they have a reason for existing that goes beyond making money. And that's what we call higher purpose. Right, Whole Foods is not just trying to sell more, you know, Twinkies and you know, and donuts. They're trying to improve your health. Right, educate people that what you put into your body makes a difference to your health, to the health of our food system, and to the health of the planet. And that's what their passion, that's what drives them, right? And that's what attracts employees to work there. That's what attracts customers to be loyal to them, suppliers, right? And investors to invest in that vision. So there was a notion of a higher purpose, which is really what connects all the stakeholders together. Shared values and shared purpose, right? It becomes like a magnet or a glue that holds them together, and it points them in one direction. This is what we're trying to create, right? There's a vision that we will achieve through our purpose. Therefore, you get everybody on the same side of the table. You don't have a lot of friction. You don't have trade-offs, right? That, you know, employees versus customers versus suppliers versus investors. Everybody's on the same side of the table. So we found those two principles, and then we said, to do that, you have to have a different kind of leaders. Leaders have to care about the purpose. They have to care about the people. And that's what we later call conscious leadership. And when you have work that is meaningful, when you have leaders who care about you, you know, you create a different kind of culture, right? Where people are excited to go to work on, they don't say, thank God it's Friday, I'm done with my work week. You know, they actually say, wow, yeah. I'm excited to get to work and do more, you know, engaging things. So it's trust and caring and all of that. So, you know, caring and conscious culture. So I kind of discovered those dimensions. And then, of course, at the end, we did the financial analysis, and we had found 28 companies that fit our pattern, you know. And we did the financial analysis expecting that because they're paying their people better, frontline people, they're paying their executives less, but they're paying their regular other people more, and investing in their benefits. They're also investing in the customer experience. They're paying their suppliers well. They're investing in the communities, investing in the environment, and paying taxes at a higher rate, 34% on average. We said maybe there's less left over for investors, because investors get paid last, right? Everybody else gets paid mm-hmm. first. Mm-hmm. And what we found, of course, was that these companies outperformed the market by 9-1, yeah, dramatically over a 10-year period. So even though they're not profit maximizing, you know, that's not their philosophy, that's not their goal, yet they generate more profits. And that's a very important lesson, right? Profits are the outcome. They're not the reason for being. If you do everything right for everybody, you create tremendous value for everybody, including shareholders, right, and investors. So that was a big aha. And for me personally, when I was writing some of the stories, it was June of 2005, and I'm writing some of the stories of these companies and what they did for their employees and for their families of employees and for the communities and how they showed up in times of natural disasters. And I found myself literally moved to tears as I was trying to write. And I said to my co-author, David, I said, David, I've never had tears of joy connected to my work. I have often had tears of anger and frustration, right? But not tears of joy. I said, I think something inside me just came alive. My body is telling me something, that this is something I want to dedicate the rest of my life to. So in a way, my purpose found me, you know? So I was not actively seeking. I knew what I did not like. I didn't like the old story of business. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Only the paranoid can survive. It's not personal, it's business. We use people, we use customers, we trick them into buying things. We do all these, we use people to make money for ourselves. And that story never appealed to me at a human level, but I just thought that's what business is. And so, and I had been writing about what doesn't work with that for me. So that was what Joseph Campbell called, you follow your heartbreak. Right, I had been doing that for 10 years, following my heartbreak, that which I did not like about business. And then you follow your bliss. What gives you greatest joy? And I discovered my bliss in 2005, right? And so that was a clarification of my purpose. And I said, from now on, because I had been a professor for 20 years at that point, and I was a pretty unhappy in my work. I found no meaning and no higher purpose in being a professor of marketing, right? It kind of happened accidentally. And, my father got his PhD in cytogenetics and plant breeding, right? He was trying to, it's plant science, basically, agriculture, right? And I got a PhD in marketing. So my inner dialogue was my father was trying to cure world hunger. And I get a PhD in marketing and I'm trying to sell you some more potato chips, right? Just market stuff. So I never respected my own profession. And I had almost a sense of shame about it. And that day, in 2005, I said, oh my God, business can be the source of joy and fulfillment and meaning and purpose and healing our communities and healing our environment and giving us a future. And so that became my passion at that point. Until then, my work was just a job, maybe a career to some extent, but not a calling. Now it became a calling. This is what I was born to do. This is what makes me alive. And that's how I met John Mackey. Because Whole Foods was one of the companies we featured. He read the book before it even was published. Somebody sent him a draft. And he reached out and said, I love this book. I read all the books and this book resonates with me so strongly. Would you come and spend a day with me? Invited me to Austin and I did. And at the end of the day, we had dinner in an Indian restaurant and I pulled out a mind map that I had created as I was thinking about what do I want to do after Firms of Endearment. And it was called the Institute for New Capitalism, or INC.
Right.
And I said, this is a different story of business. And I want to dedicate my life to building this idea with academia, with CEOs, with the whole world. And of course, it was a very ambitious idea for me, just a professor at one university, to be having that. But I showed it to him and he looked at it and he said, that's exactly my vision. But I like the phrase conscious capitalism. Right. And I said, I had never heard that before. Now, he didn't invent that phrase. The phrase was invented by Muhammad Yunus, who created the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. The whole idea of micro lending, using banking as a way not to make rich people more rich, but actually a way to uplift poor people and give them an opportunity to rise out of extreme poverty. And so he had called that conscious capitalism, but we were defining it differently. So he was referring to what we call a social business. That only has a social purpose. The only purpose of Grameen Bank is to help those poor women, mostly, right, rise from poverty. And all the earnings they get, they reinvest back into the business. And we were saying that actually society should be a stakeholder of every business, but it's also good to have financial returns. Because if every business becomes a social business, then we don't have profits, we don't have taxes, and therefore society cannot function. governments cannot create wealth. They can only spend, you know, the taxes that they generate from business, right? So we have used it in a different way. But so that was the beginning, and that was in 2007 that he and I met, October. And in February of 2008, we had a retreat at his ranch, and we each invited half a dozen people and talked about how can we launch a movement. And that October of 2008 is when we had our first big gathering, a conference, just when the financial crisis was hitting.
Right? Exactly. That was what I was going to say.
Yeah, that was a coincidence. We didn't come out of the financial crisis saying we need a new capitalism. We were already doing that, and then the financial crisis happened, which just underlined the need for thinking differently about business. So that's kind of the backstory of how all this came about for me. And from that day on, you know, my work has been a source of deep joy and fulfillment. The last 15 years have been very different than the previous 20, you know. And one of the other things that I would say I realized only recently, 2 years ago, because, you know, my father and mother are very different energies. My father is a dominant, patriarchal, you know, hyper-masculine, aggressive, you know, in all of that energy, right? And I come from a community in India, which is the warrior caste. You know, India has all these castes, right? So he brought that energy, and I never related to that. That's not me. But my mother was just pure love and taking care of everybody, and empathy and inclusiveness and, you know, forgiveness and all of that. And so that energy was really more in me, but I felt in order to succeed in the world, I have to be like my father. Yeah, you have to be rough and tough and aggressive, and that was not natural to me, right? So I spent, I would say, 45 years trying to be that. But then 15 years ago, I stumbled onto a path which was really more reflecting my mother's energy. And so that's what I learned 2 years ago when I worked with a coach for the first time. I was turning 60. I was writing this book about healing. People told me, you need to work on your own healing, right? So as part of that, I did a whole bunch of experiences. I went to the Himalayas, you know, the India-China border, you know, to learn about Buddhism. I went to Ecuador in the rainforest to learn about nature, you know, and with the shamans. And I went to a silent retreat, and I worked with a coach. And she told me, after she heard my story, she said, do you realize that you've been honoring your mother with your work the last 15 years? Before that, you were trying to impress your father, and that never worked. And now you found your true calling, which is really to bring your mother's energy to the world. And I feel like this is a universal need, that the world has had enough of the hyper-masculine energy. Domination, aggression, you know, wars.
Competition.
Hyper-competition, winning at all costs. Winning is the only thing that matters, you know. You kill or be killed and all of that. Whereas the higher human qualities are nurturing, caring, compassion, empathy, inclusiveness, love, you know, and that's, we call that the feminine. And my, you know, in my case, my parents embodied that very purely. My father was extreme on this side. My mother was extreme on this side. Now, of course, we believe we need the healthy masculine and healthy feminine together, right? It's not about let's get rid of all masculine and only have feminine. We need the healthy, beautiful feminine energy to be leading, but we also need the courage and focus and resilience and, you know, determination, which we consider normally to be the healthy masculine. So anyway, it's been a journey of understanding my own life and understanding my own forces that shaped me and bringing that to the world and then continuing along those lines, so learning more and going deeper, you know.
I believe, Raj, that your story will definitely connect with a lot of people. You know, the path you had just told us is pretty similar to, unfortunately, to the majority of the people. They have a career, but they don't enjoy it. They only think about competing. They only think about making money and how that their families can be better and survive. You could say so. And it's hard. It's hard to hear that everyone is living in the same way. We're living these empty lives, and our definition of success, it's pretty shallow.
We live by impressing people and not honoring our own self.
That's right. So that's why I'm working on a very personal book now, which I'm trying to distill all the lessons. It's part of it is memoir and part of it is manual. what have I learned in my now 62 years, and how would I put it all together and connect the dots, right? And so it really starts with knowing yourself, right? Who are you? What's your essence, right? And I was a particular kind of child, and you really have to go back to your childhood, right? I was very trusting. I just implicitly trusted people. I was very idealistic. I wanted things to be, you know, perfect in every way. I was very peace-loving. I never got into a fight. You know, in 62 years, I never had one fight with my brother, my sister, you know, anybody, right? Very peace-loving. You know, fairly academic-minded, you know, in that way. And my father would tell me, you cannot trust anybody. You should not trust anybody, right? If I'm too peace-loving, he said, no, you need to be rough and tough. You know, or if I'm too idealistic, you know, you need to be pragmatic, not ideal. You cannot be idealistic in this world, right? And if I was good in school, he said, that doesn't matter. You need to be street smart, right? So when you get those kinds of messages from the person that you look up to the most, right?
Yeah.
The father. So what it said to me was, to the extent that I knew myself, I knew that this is how I was born. The second step is you have to love yourself, right? And when I got all those messages from my father, it's like, even if I know myself, I kind of hate myself because I think that all of these are weaknesses, right? So everything that comes naturally to me is a defect. I need to be the opposite of who I am. That's the message I got, right? For 40 years or more. And so that's a big leap. You have to know yourself, and then you have to come to love yourself, right? And recognize those are your gifts, right? And that's what you were born with, and that's what is going to come into the world through you. And then the third is you have to be yourself. You have to then live into that and express that into the world, right? And then you have to heal yourself as well, right? You have to heal all the things that happened in your childhood. And you know, all of us have some kind of trauma in us, inside us. Life is difficult as it is. And then there are other things that happen, right? So if you don't heal those traumas, if you don't face up to them, then, you know, you are wounded inside, and then you bring that suffering to other people until you, you know, try to heal that within you and come to understand it. And then actually the next step beyond that is you choose your life, right? You not only accept everything that happened in your life, you choose it. You say, you know, I experienced this when I was 8 years old, and it was really painful at the time. But because of that, I became sensitized to this. So I had to experience the worst of the hyper-masculine and, you know, abusive behavior when I was a kid in my culture, in my family, in fact, so that 45 years later, I could write a book about the feminine, right? The Shakti leadership, right? So there's a dot, there's a connection. So therefore, I choose those experiences, even though they were painful, right? So you choose your life, then you're not a victim anymore. Then you can actually learn and use what happened. Otherwise, you feel like a victim, right? So there are steps like that, you know, there are about 10 of them that I have thought about and how they impacted me in my life, you know, and how maybe that can help other people to think about these things.
And what I was going to say is, the other day I heard your podcast and you said the three most important words. It's the me, the us, and the world. And everything you just said, it's the same thing. Just heal me so that I can impact others, so that I can create a difference in the world. And for me, that's really valuable. And that's a different way of how we perceive ourselves and the impact we can have in the world we're living in. And if everyone were to think in the same way, in the same connection, we would definitely have a more healthy society, a less damaged planet, or we can even try to revert all of those things that we're facing today. No?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So we call that triple vision, right? And it's heal me, serve we, impact the world. And it has to start with healing me, right? Because what happens a lot of times when people become leaders, and very, very conscious people, when conscious leaders, right? The big blind spot they often have, because they're so much about serving other people and, you know, trying to impact, but they forget about themselves, right? And you sacrifice your own health, physical, mental, emotional, right? Well-being, because you're so much, and you burn out. And so unless you heal yourself and take care of it, you are your most important stakeholder. And that sounds like a selfish thing to say, but actually it's the most generous thing to do. Because unless you take care of yourself, you cannot be there for anybody else, right? So you have to start there and you have to look within. And for me, as I said, this is very recent learning. I mean, I would say that even after I found my purpose in 2005 and then the whole movement, until 2 years ago, I had swept so many things under the carpet. I was not dealing with my own traumas. Okay, things that happened to my with my childhood, my relationship to my father, you know, he cut me off for 5 years. There were many, many things that I had just buried in my psyche and I was just going on and I was running from airport to airport and project to project and, you know, never stopping to really, you know, be with myself and understand what was going on. And all those experiences 2 years ago forced me to look inward and recognize that there was a lot of healing that needed to happen. There were conversations I needed to have, you know, with my father. There was closure I needed to have, etc. And one of the interesting things also was my coach told me, you've been honoring your mother. And then she said, does your mother know that? And I said, well, I didn't know that. How would she know that? So I said, no, you need to call her and tell her that, right? You need to call her and tell her that right away that you have been honoring her with your work. And I said, well, you know, we don't talk like that in my family. You know, we talk about the weather and we talk about how are you feeling. You know, we don't talk about real things like this. And she said, no, you need to call her and tell her. I said, well, my father always picks up the phone and he puts it on speaker and they're always sitting and he's going to hear that. He's going to say, what's wrong with him? Why is he talking like this? You know, I can't have a private conversation. She said, no, I don't care. You need to call her. I said, well, I'm going to India in 3 weeks. I'll tell her in person. She said, no, your mother is 82 years old. Right? You don't know what happens in 3 weeks, so you need to call her. So I called her the next morning, and it turned out to be the most healing conversation. Because as soon as I told her that, I called her mummy, I said, you know, everything I've been doing the last 15 years that people have responded to that has made a difference in the world is because of you and what you stood for and what you taught us and what you showed us, you know, how to be. And she just started crying. She said, oh, I am nothing. I am nothing. And I said, no, you are everything. You know, she thought of herself as less than because she was only educated until the eighth grade. You know, my father got his PhD and won a gold medal and he was a famous scientist. So she didn't speak English and she just was a simple, loving, you know, caring human being. But she just thought, okay, I don't matter in the world. And I said, no, what you did matters so much more because the world has enough of what Papa stands for, right? What he brought. And we need some of that, but what the world really needs is what you stand for. You know, therefore, I've been able to bring that and trying to bring that into the world. So it was just very healing for her near the end of her life. She died last year, you know, to hear that and to know that her life, which she thought had no meaning, you know, like she would even say, like, well, I don't even know what I did with my life, you know. And to say, no, that you're through your actions, you are now impacting many people through me and other people, right? And my brother is healing the land. My sister is working on healing families. You know, she's doing her own work. So we're all, as your children, manifesting this into the world. You know? So I think those kinds of experiences 2 years ago were very healing for me and even to come to peace with my father. So I think we all have to go through some version of these things. You know, as we say, that which is deeply personal is also completely universal, right? Carla, as you were saying, so many people have somewhat similar experiences. And you know, this whole father wound, you know, trying to be worthy, live up to the father and be, you know, bring that energy into the world. You know? It's all, you know, we've created this world, as you were saying, where we measure success and think about life in the wrong ways. We measure it by money and power and we find some of the most miserable people have money and power, right? And so we need to define our purpose differently. One of the things I learned in the rainforest with those shamans in Ecuador, the Achuar and the Zapara people, right? So there's a very sort of dream-based cultures. They believe a lot in the power of dreams. And one of their expressions is that the world is as you dream it, right? So what we create is what starts here. Everything we look around existed in somebody's mind before it became in the world, right? Except for nature. And so if we don't like what we have created, we need to dream a new dream, right? We need to have a new dream that has different aspects to it, right? So that, and then we can go about creating that. But it starts by sort of, we have to wake up from this illusion that we are trapped inside, that this is what life is about, this is what success is about, this is what achievement is, you know, etc. And then go back and dream a new dream for ourselves, and for for our collective, right, selves, a more beautiful dream, and then we create that more beautiful world.
Raj, you've been talking about your journey, and I would like to ask you something. I wasn't thinking about asking you this, but you're talking about how you heal yourself, and from how you're telling your story, like, it even made me want to cry because about how I relate to your story, you know, the way I didn't find purpose, the way I relate with my family, the way things I have in my past that I'm working on. And I really want to ask you, how can anybody start, like, really turn on that light of starting to know yourself and to love yourself?
Yeah, well, that's what this new book is about. It's called Awaken, My Path to Inner Peace, Healing, and a Life of Purpose. And I'm trying to share what I've learned and also trying to distill the wisdom of others. I mean, this is, you know, a lot of these things have been written about a lot, right? So I'm trying to distill that down into this book and share that. But I think it really starts, Pablo, with, as I said, I mean, that sequence of steps, I think, is essential, right? You have to know who you are, and then you have to come to respect who you are and love who you are. Because we get messages from outside. See, we live our lives based upon other people's opinions, other people's beliefs, you know, and our parents, our teachers, society, everybody else. We have to tune into our own heart, right? You have to turn up the volume and listen to that louder than we hear the other voices, right? Because right now we have completely disconnected. We don't hear that at all. And, you know, most of my life was that. Nobody asked me when I was in high school, what do you want to be? Right? I was good in math and science, so I had to be an engineer, you know. But if somebody asked me and I had that conversation, I would say, I'd really love to be a journalist. I would love to be an investigative reporter, writer, you know. But we don't have that. But so anyway, we go through life and do all these things based upon other factors. But at some point, you have to reconnect to yourself, right? And I think for that, you know, we have to have some spiritual explorations. You know, there's lots of different ways in which we can do that. There are many different experiences that are available out there, right, for us to go into that contemplative space. One of the important things for me was going into silence. I went on a 4-day silent retreat with a group of 35 people, and I received so much wisdom, you know, just in silence, right, being with myself. See, we are so consumed by information and noise and, you know, everything around us, we are never able to quiet our mind and actually look inward, go tune inward, right? And I think that's what we have to do. And also understand who we were as a child, people who knew you when you were very small, right? Before the world took hold of you and shaped you, right? And put all these layers on you. What was your essence? You know, in India, we say, what was your swabhav, your true nature? Right? And I was living opposite to my true nature for decades. And that's a formula for being miserable, right? I was unhappy personally. I was unhappy professionally, you know, every aspect. And slowly now it's about bringing everything into alignment, every aspect, right? Who you are, what you say, what you do, your personal life, your work life, family life, you know, relationships, everything in alignment, I think, is the goal. And it's a never-ending journey. But we can start it now. One of the things that I feel really helped me, and all the way, by the way, all of this started for me, a little bit of exploration started in 2007 when I wrote Firms of Endearment. Before that, I had no spiritual experience whatsoever. You know, I only had one Art of Living course, my sister, when I was writing Firms of Endearment. So it really started with that. I took a course called Art of Living, which was started by one of the Indian gurus. You know, India has a lot of gurus. So he started this course, and my sister kind of encouraged me to take it. And there was a lot of beautiful wisdom there, right? And I said, wow, nobody ever taught me these things growing up, right? And then I wrote the book, and then I was in India for my MBA reunion, 25th reunion. The book was coming out in a month, so I had a pre-publication version of the book, and I gave it to my professor there, who was really my mentor in my MBA program. And the next day I went to see him, and he said, you know, Raj, normally I go to bed at 8 because I get up at 4, but last night I was up until 11 reading your book. I said, wow, that means a lot to me. He said, yes, I'm really enjoying it. But as I read it, I realize it's nothing new. I said, what do you mean? He said, everything you are writing here was written 4,000 years ago. I said, where? I didn't read any management book from 4,000 years ago. It's in the Gita. The Gita is one of the Indian texts, right? The spiritual teachings. Very small book, actually. It's just lessons about life. And I said, I never read the Gita. Nobody told me to read the Gita, you know? So there's something in the ancient wisdom, right? And I'm not talking about just religion and belief this and, you know, God and fairies. And, you know, I'm talking about the actual underlying wisdom that we need to connect to, because people have thought about these things for a long time, you know? So I think exploring those kinds of things, so that started for me then at some level, and I continued that, reading some spiritual kinds of books, you know, about many of these ideas. And then 2 years ago, one of the experiences I had when I went to the Amazon rainforest with a group called the Pachamama Alliance. Now, Pachamama means Mother Earth, right? And it started by Lynn Twist. And they're trying to do two things. They're trying to protect the rainforest, which is a collective, thing that all of us on this planet depend upon, right? And you guys are stewards of that in Brazil, along with some of the other countries. But understanding the importance to protect the rainforest, but also understanding the indigenous wisdom that exists in the native peoples of those regions, right? That they have lived in harmony with nature. They know how to be with nature. And we in the modern world have disconnected from nature, right? I mean, we look at it from our window, but we're really not, you know, connected to it in the way they are. And so we think of ourselves as, we are here and nature is here. When they say, well, you know, we are as much as part of nature as a tree, right? We don't come into this world. We come out of this world, right? From this world. And so making that connection, they said, you know, we connect in the West and the modern world, we connect with each other from here, right? Head, right? And so we need to connect from here, from spirit. Spirit, and even not just with people, with other living things, with trees, even with stones and rocks and rivers have their spirit in their view. So it's a very different way of thinking. But one of the other things, of course, they do is in terms of exploring deeper consciousness is ayahuasca journey, right? You know about ayahuasca, right? So the opportunity in that whole 10 days was to have an ayahuasca journey with a real shaman. You know, deep inside the rainforest, on the banks of a river, under the stars. It was a lunar eclipse night. You could see six planets lined up, wow. You know, and we were lying on banana leaves on the dirt, looking up at the sky next to a river. And the shaman was, you know, chanting and blowing and whistling and, you know, waving a branch above us. And it was a most profound experience because it shifted. It gave me access to parts of my subconscious, which I did not have access to. You know, it almost took me back to my childhood and showed me like a movie of my childhood with some commentary saying, this is what you experienced when you were 2, when you were 5, and this is what it impacted made on you. And therefore, when you were 55 and 60, this is what, you know, happened to you or what you were able to do, you know, connecting this, sort of putting all the pieces together. And I also had, you know, I cried for, I think, an hour, and I was emotionally locked up. I had not been able to grieve for tragic things that happened. People died, and somehow I was never able to express my grief, and now suddenly it opened me up. And I also got wisdom about healing. You know, I got these 4 words that were floating in my vision as I was lying there, and it said, this is what the world needs to heal. This is what the world of business needs to heal. And the 4 words were love, innocence, simplicity, and truth. Okay? That we need to operate from love. In the world of business, we don't. We operate from selfishness and self-interest. We use other people, right, to achieve our own goals, make as much money as possible. But we need to operate from love, which means to care for them. And so what can I do to make your life better? And, you know, it's innocence. We are all born innocent, but we lose our innocence, right? We become corrupted when we hurt other people, when we take advantage of other people, right? So we have to go back to a kind of innocence. And my mother was an embodiment of that. Even at the age of 83, she was almost pure innocence, you know? She had no guile, she had no agenda, she had no manipulation, you know, she had, all she wanted was to, you know, take care of people and be, you know, just be good, right? So we need to reconnect to our innocence, because innocence is a quality we are all born with, but we have to go back and reclaim it. Just like I was born with idealism and trust and peaceful nature, I have to go back and choose those qualities so that they can serve me, right? I was rejecting them, I have to choose them. But innocence is something we all have. I think we have to choose. And think about how you would operate if you had innocence, how you would operate as a president of a country, or how you would operate as a, you know, you think about Dalai Lama, or you think about Desmond Tutu, or you think about even Gandhi and others. There was a kind of innocence to them, right? Childlike. This is the child energy, the pure child, the innocent child, you know. But it's not the weak, helpless child. It is the innocence on the other side of wholeness. As a strong adult, you're choosing to act with innocence. It's not naive, it's not helpless, but it is still a kind of innocence. So love, innocence, simplicity. You know, we have made everything so complicated in this world. We hide behind the complexity. If you think about the 2008 financial crisis, it was all these, you know, derivatives and these financial instruments that nobody understood. Even the people selling them and people buying them didn't understand. They just thought, oh, I can make money by doing this. A lot of complexity. You know, the real truth lies on the other side of complexity, which is the simplicity on the other side of complexity. And that the last word is truth. What is our commitment to the truth? You know, I'm a professor of marketing. There's nothing called truth in marketing, you know, very little truth, right? And so we have to have a commitment to the truth. And so anyway, these were the kinds of lessons I got. And the last one I'll tell you, one more I want to share with you, which is, I got an image all in that same night, ayahuasca, right? So it's like looking from above and there's a long line of people, thousands of people, waiting, standing in line under the hot sun. And at the end of the line, there's a tiny little woman. And she's hugging everybody one by one, right? Now, this woman is known as the hugging saint. She's Amma. She's called Amma, which means mother. She's a woman from India. And she travels all over the world. And all she does is she hugs people. Okay? And they experience unconditional love in that hug. So people stand in line for 8 hours. They come to the front of the line and she doesn't even speak English. They get a hug from her and they burst out into tears and they walk away, right? They just felt something. Unconditional love. People are starving for that, right? Now, the message I got was that all of these people standing in this line, they could be hugging each other. They have what they are looking for. They have what they're looking for. You don't need to go somewhere else and find another person. That all of us as human beings, we have what we need to heal for each other. We have within us and then we have with each other, right? Because most of our suffering is caused by us on each other or on ourselves, right? But the answer to the healing also is each other and within, looking, understanding ourselves. So it was those kinds of lessons, you know? So I believe that these experiences, you know, this ayahuasca type of thing, which give you access to, this is not like a recreational drug and you're trying to get drunk or whatever. This is a very sacred, you do it with a shaman, right?
With a purpose.
You're trying to understand about life. And, you know, and the ayahuasca is supposed to be, have the grandmother energy. It is supposed to be the grandmother, you know, connecting you to the planet and to the mother energy, right? And I really felt that. I felt I was lying in my mother's lap when I was lying there under this experience. You know? So I think these kinds of things exist in nature. They have existed in human civilizations for thousands of years for a reason, because it gives us access to a level of consciousness that otherwise we don't often have. You know, now with meditation and silence, we might be able to get there. But for many of us, you know, that's not viable. You know, this is an alternative path. So I encourage people to do this kind of thing as well. You know, if you want to become a more conscious human being, be open to these kinds of experiences in a very guided, controlled, you know, a sort of a sacred way.
We've dedicated this chapter towards more a personal journey. Most of our chapters have been focused towards businesses, entrepreneurship, and movements. However, for me, Raj, this chapter is more special because we need to start within ourselves, and then that will create an impact in the world. So for me, the last question we'd like to do to all our guests is, for you, what is a conscious capitalist? How does a conscious capitalist look like?
Well, a conscious capitalist is, I would say, first of all, a whole person. They have worked on themselves to become a whole person. What do I mean by whole? That means that they have healed the inner divides that exist within them. We talk about the masculine and feminine divide, right? We are born with a certain gender, but all of us have the masculine, feminine energy inside us. But we have suppressed the feminine side, right? Men and women have suppressed that in society. So we need to integrate that. As Carl Jung said, every man has an inner woman, every woman has an inner man. So integrate the masculine, feminine, as we talked about. But there's also the higher self and the child self. We need to integrate the elder energy and the child energy. We need to have access to the meaning and wisdom and purpose in our lives and thinking beyond our lifetime. But we also have to have the joy and the innocence and the playfulness and the humor and creativity of the child. So all those energies have to be harmonized and integrated within us. You know, most of us have a default that we come from wisdom or we come from love or we come from, you know. So the phrase we use is wise fool of tough love. Can you become wise and foolish, right? Tough and loving all together at the same time. So I think a conscious capitalist is somebody who's a whole person. And when you do all of those four things, that means you have a sense of purpose, right? That means you're operating from love. The foundation is love. But you are strong, you have personal power, right? So operating from love without power, without strength, makes you ineffective. So you need both, right? Strength without love is tyranny. Love without strength is ineffective. So we need both, right? So a conscious capitalist, a conscious leader has coming from love, but has great courage and personal power, right? They have the wisdom that it takes, right, to live with meaning and purpose. And yet they don't take themselves seriously and they have the capacity for joy and laughter and connecting with other people. And so I think when you become that kind of a human being, so that's a conscious human being. And then when you go into business, you're going to be a conscious leader and you're going to do everything in the business that we talk about here. That will come automatically, naturally to you because all of those things are in harmony now with your higher consciousness, right? So I think that's what we need to work towards. You cannot have a conscious business without a conscious leader, and you cannot be a conscious leader unless you're a conscious human being. So the primary journey for all of us is to work on becoming a more conscious human being. And how do we do that? And then we can learn the tactics and the, you know, the different elements of how do we implement this. And that is relatively straightforward. But the biggest task for us is to work on our own consciousness.
Great. Well, thank you so much for today's conversation. It was so
enlightening.
Yeah. I just want to ask one last question, which is where can people find you? Where can people connect with you?
Yeah, there's my website is rajchisoria.com. Just my name spelling. We do have a podcast now called the Conscious Capitalists .org, I think, or .com. I think it's .com. Conscious Capitalists with an S. So those are two ways to connect. And yeah, beyond that, I think there's a lot of material on the web for the different books. Firms of Endearment has a website. Healing Organizations has a website, etc. So this. There's more than enough information on the web. It's hard, you know, there's no place to hide.
Great.
Raj, thank you very much for being here.
So I encourage people to connect with conscious capitalism in their local country. If there is a chapter, if there isn't a chapter, then I encourage people to come together and look into what it takes to start a chapter.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure having you here.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, guys. Good to meet you.
Esta segunda temporada es presentada por Integralis,
ayudando a las organizaciones a construir un mejor normal.